Midweek Motorsport.
Midweek Motorsport with John Hindhoff.
RadioLeMans.com.
Well, last Wednesday, the iconic committee announced its decision on the way forward for IndyCar for the 4 years from 2012. We'll talk about the details of that decision in the next half an hour or so. I'm delighted to say that joining us once again here on Midweek Motorsport, the Indy Racing League CEO, is Randy Bernard. And along with him this evening, we have team owner and member of the committee, Gilles de Ferran, and technical member of the committee, Tony Pennell. Randy, Gilles, Tony, thank you very much for your time, first of all.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Randy, I know that you have got a plane to catch, so we're under a little bit of time pressure, and I want to make the listeners aware of that straight away. We've got an inordinate, you know what our listeners have like, you've dealt with them before. We've got an inordinate amount of points to get through about the announcement that Dallara would be the chassis manufacturer for the 4 years from 2012. The first point that I'd like to ask you, it's a small but an important one, that the announcement was delayed by a couple of weeks. What was the reason to do that? And the reason I ask this is that there seems to be a feeling that this was potentially done to allow Dallara to cherry pick the best elements from the other submissions.
Absolutely not. First of all, on the entire timeline that we laid out, we started 2 weeks later than I had anticipated, and that was primarily because of selecting the 7 correct people for this advisory committee. I had about 110 people on my list that I was talking with, and that was really what took the longest. It was my fault, not anyone else's. Once we started the process with the Iconic Advisory Committee, we were 100% on time on our timeline. I mean, it was right on spot. We didn't have any time to mess around with. We could have made an announcement on July 2nd, July 3rd, probably. First of all, July 4th is a big holiday over here. It didn't make sense to me to rush something that was so big. July 14th is one of the lowest press-related days to sports in the United States. It's the day after the All-Star game, so there's no baseball, and I felt it was a very good reason to hold it for 14 days and have it on a day that I believe I could create more press and more hype on it. And so those were the biggest reasons why we did it then.
When was the decision actually made as far as it being Dallara? And the reason I ask that is because Jen Rafstel, the president of Swift, has already said, we were doubtful we had a chance when we heard they weren't going to announce a selection until the 14th. And I can't imagine IndyCar entering into a deal with anyone without having some limited discussions about how the deal was going to work. And to be frank, nobody believes that Dallara produced the renderings and the holograms that you showed at the announcement just in case they won. And I'm told by somebody who knows these things, it would have taken them at least a week to produce. So the decision was made in advance of last Wednesday then.
Well, what the advisory committee did was ratify the decision. And we did that as a mere way of keeping rumors away. In IndyCar for the past many years, it's been very, history has shown that there has never been a good secret. Everything has been released and known way prior to any announcement. And I wanted to keep everybody guessing right up to the last minute. But yes, you are correct. The decision was actually made on July 1st. The committee decided at that point which way, who they wanted to give first opportunity to. Now, we invited Dallara in, but we had a second, third, and fourth that were right behind. If Dallara would not have, if the negotiations would not have completed or finished very well, we would have gone to number two. So it really was after July 1 for Dallara to win or lose the bid. At that point, on July 1st or 2nd, we asked them to fly over, and I believe the holiday was July. Monday was a day off, and so it was July 6th. We asked them to be in the office on the morning of July 6th to start those negotiations. We told them they had 2 days. If they couldn't complete that deal, and then we would be going to the next chassis manufacturer on the list.
OK. Okay, thank you for your candour in that. I think that's the first time that that's been mentioned, Randy. Thank you. I'd like to bring in a couple of the questions from fans pretty early on this, because we've got far too many than I'll ever be able to fit in. And bring in Gilles Deferrin, who was effectively the conduit to the teams in the iconic committee. Hello, Gilles.
How are you?
I'm good, sir. This is coming from a guy called Gonzo, who posts on one of the big IndyCar fan forums and is taking the time to email into it. He says, from a team's point of view, can you explain to me how the decision made for this new car is likely to inspire and interest fans and bring exciting competitive action back to the track? Can Gilles honestly sit here and say that the new car and direction is a better car than the 97 Reynard he drove to second place in the 97 championship against Unser, Zanardi and Andretti, or a more exciting car than the Penske Reynard Honda that he did 241.428 miles an hour at Fontana? Because if it isn't, what have you accomplished to satisfy the fans?
Well, that's a very, very good question. And frankly, that was one of the key things that I think was in the mind of the whole committee, you know, that this car needs to break new ground in terms of performance, you know. Frankly, it needs to regain some of the aura that I think IndyCar held in the past, you know, from a performance perspective, you know. At least to my mind, IndyCars have always been, you know, kind of a bit extreme, you know. Maybe could be considered as the original extreme sport. So, you know, going forward, I think it was important not only to maintain that status, but perhaps to enhance that status to your listeners' point. So, in terms of performance, I think the car will be definitely quicker than the car we have today. Certainly on road courses where we're targeting quite a bit of an improvement in lift over drag performance, which means kind of aerodynamic performance of the car versus what it is today. So the car is aerodynamically more efficient. In road courses, it will definitely have more horsepower, and it will be a lighter car. So we're targeting a performance improvement, I think, between 3 and 6% of what we have today, which is frankly very similar, if not quicker, to those cars that your listener mentioned in the past. You know, on the ovals, it's a little bit of a different story, you know. Frankly, when we were doing 241 miles an hour back in the day in Fontana, I would say that the risk factor was probably a little bit on the high side. You know, there has been some great improvements made in the safety of racetracks, you know, and also in the construction of the cars. You know, actually, that was one of the key drivers behind trying to push the decision towards 2012. Because there has been made great strides in the safety of racing cars, and we want to take advantage of that. So you know, on the ovals, I think with safety factor permitting, I think nobody would be against creeping up speeds. But we need to do the homework and do a little bit of scientific studies here and trying to understand how far we can push the limit. In short, one of the objectives of bringing new machinery is exactly to enhance the performance of the car and regain some of that old aura that IndyCars always had.
I'll come back to you in a moment, Gilles, because I'd like to have some perspective on what the other team owners have been telling you and what input they had into the decision making progress. But I'd like to bring Tony Purnell in here, who is a very highly respected, most of you will know Tony's name. He's been involved with Formula One for many years and various other forms of motorsport. Tony, one of the things that is hoped that this new set of regulations, when the full regulations appear, but this decision will make, is that it will encourage other people into the sport who aren't there at the moment, perhaps other original equipment manufacturers, OEMs, other race car manufacturers, in terms of the aero kits. How easy or difficult is that going to be, with your experience in Formula One, for a team, a entity, to be able to bolt on their own aero kit onto effectively a spec chassis and make it work and make it competitive?
Well, first of all, one of the big challenges was to lower the barrier to entry, so far more people would consider a IndyCar entry. We felt that was very important to add to the interest and the excitement of the series. If there was a way to bring in some big names that everybody's familiar with, perhaps a Ferrari, a Lotus, a McLaren, that would be something that I think would be greeted with loud applause by the American audience. We needed to find a way to entice them, but make the financial barriers to entry as low as conceivable. So rather than competing on all aspects of a chassis, which to do to the engineering standards that have evolved over the last 10 years is an extraordinarily expensive exercise, we decided just to have really one aspect of competition on the chassis, which was the big performance differentiator, the aerodynamics. And of course there was a little bit of more than a little bit of thinking that some of the big names that I just mentioned are wonderfully equipped to produce the world's best aerodynamic cars. If you look at say Ferrari or McLaren, they have not just one wind tunnel, they have a couple. They have invested huge sums of money in computational fluid dynamics, which is beginning to take over from wind tunnel testing. And they've actually invested a huge amount of money in staff to develop aerodynamic bits. So if you have all that capability already, the marginal cost of developing the bodywork, especially when the fixing points for that bodywork to attach to are absolutely set in stone, mm-hmm. that's a very low cost. So I don't think we could have made it a lower barrier or a more enticing set of circumstances to bring these people in. And as for the technical issue, it's as an engineer, fabulous. All I'd need is my boss to say, just do it. And we'd get the drawings from Dallara, and, you know, off we'd go. And certainly if I was working for a Formula One team, I'd like to think that I would produce a better car than anybody else out there.
When you say marginal, what do you mean? A couple of million dollars for an iteration of an aero kit?
Yes. Of course, you know, in motor racing, it all depends on what the competition are doing. Mm-hmm. So I suspect that there's going to be a little bit of reticence at first. It always takes a bit of time to get things going. So I think the people who jump first will have a sizable advantage because it won't cost a lot, as you say, a couple of million dollars to produce, I would think, a standard of bodywork kit that hasn't been seen in IndyCar in a decade or so, because it simply hasn't enjoyed that from all the advances in aero. But of course, you know, if we're really successful and we have, you know, 10 different chassis and they're all competing tooth and nail against each other, then, you know, getting a better set of bodywork than the other guys will cost a bit more.
Yeah.
But for me, that's a great problem to have.
Randy, if I can bring you back in here, there's been various reports which are not attributed to yourselves, I have to say, that there will be some kind of license agreement fee to be paid for anyone who wants to produce a body kit. Is that in the plans, or are you just going to throw it open to anyone who wants to be involved? The figure of $200,000 has been mentioned in a number of different places.
Yeah, I've seen that number thrown out there. And that was interesting to me because, you know, as we sit and look at our plan, the one thing that we've looked at is how we make sure that we keep up with the technical team to give the sophisticated amount of the team in place that we need. Of course, that's going to be finance. And, you know, I think I was the one that threw that out there in a private iconic meeting. So it was thrown out there, but it was only thrown out there the way from a business standpoint. The Iconic Advisory Committee did not say yes or no to it, and you know, so I'm not sure where it stands right now. But I can tell you that there has been no decision in any way or form of anything like that.
What Tony was saying there is very interesting. In that, you know, even with current cost capping, Formula One teams, organisations may have the facilities to be able to turn some of these aero kits around. That clearly, however, doesn't help one of the boxes that you want to tick, which is to provide some work inside Indiana and in Speedway Indiana. There's a quite a large amount of local government funding for this, with I think it's $5 million on the table, isn't it, for the facility, and then $120,000 discount for anyone who bases themselves per chassis in the area. So would that disappoint you, Randy, in some respect? Obviously, it's a double-edged sword. Be great if somebody like Ferrari or McLaren did want to get involved, but then it takes the building of the cars, the business of the cars away from Speedway Indiana.
Absolutely not. I would answer that as 70% of the car will be made in Speedway Indiana. The governor realizes, and the state of Indiana realizes, that there'll be 80 jobs that will come to the state. There'll be a fan experience. There'll be simulators. There'll be a restaurant. There'll be what we're trying to do is make sure that the core of IndyCar, the shops, the team owners, stay in Indianapolis. So we're reaching our goal with that. And to have a Ferrari or a McLaren or any other auto manufacturer join the series and compete only adds to the benefits of what we're trying to do. The more competition that we can bring in will only bring more people to the state of Indiana for the Indianapolis 500. The positives completely outweigh the negatives, and so we will definitely be encouraging any European auto manufacturer as well. Now, we're also going to be enhancing and wanting to see some of the aerodynamic companies come in, Raytheon or Boeing or McDonnell Douglas. We think this is a great platform for them to showcase some of their advancements in the world of aerodynamics.
I'd like to talk a little bit about engines, because quite clearly the heart and soul of any racing machine is what pushes it forward. The chassis, clearly a very important part. Engines, you've made some decisions on engines, and I'd like to know, and Randy, I'm not sure if you want to take this, or whether you want to push it off to Tony or one of the other guys, whether Gilles comes in as well, but I'd just like to know what talks, if any, you've been able to have with car manufacturers, auto manufacturers, not only in the US but worldwide, regarding the supply of engines, and whether they would this, and I ask this again, and I'll justify this with a few listener comments, have said that it seems at the moment that motor manufacturers are trying to amortize their investment across a number of series, and particularly make it a relevant technology to what they sell from the showrooms, and that would suggest stock block or stock based engines, and you seem not to have gone that route. What's the thinking behind that, Randy?
The only part I'll answer on that is, first of all, we have talked to auto manufacturers. Jill DeFerrin and I have had a couple of meetings our meetings were outstanding, and these were very, these were with president, one of them was with the president of a major auto manufacturer, and he was very encouraged with the direction that the Iconic Advisory Committee went. I know that Tony Purnell has had some conversations with several different companies over in Europe. We were very selective on who we talked to prior to our announcement because we wanted to keep everything secretive and confidential up through the announcement. But now I'd like to let you ask that question to Jill and Tony on the reasoning of the relevance, because I think that they could answer that better than me, of course.
I think that's a relatively easy one. I mean, obviously, you know, we're not operating in a vacuum here. So to Randy's point, I think we reached out to a lot of experts in the field of racing engines, trying to understand what would be the best solution to the problem you mentioned, as well as major manufacturers. And to the question of stock block or shall we say a engine that is derived from a road car engine, you know, the conclusion was clearly that it turns out that it's probably more costly to develop an engine that was originally designed with different priorities in mind, you know, to produce the level of performance, power, and reliability that you need out of a racing engine, than producing designing and producing a racing engine from scratch. On the issue of producing relevant challenges, you know, challenges that relate to the showroom and developing technologies that can be used in the road cars in the future, I think the focus there is mostly on efficiency. So the engine is it's a smaller engine, you know. We're asking that smaller engine to produce more horsepower and to be more durable than what the current engine has. And we're also investigating methods of to limit the amount of fuel. So you are being asked to make more with less. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very relevant challenge that we all faced in every corner of the globe. And that was very much part of the intent behind the engine rules. I don't know if Tony may have something to add on that.
Tony, what can an engine manufacturer learn from IndyCar racing that they can't in other forms of racing, say touring cars, GTs, or even F1?
Well, I'd like to think that they'll learn that America is a fantastic market to sell road cars. They know that already. And the IndyCar series, especially the Indy 500, is the perfect place to showcase that capability. It's all very well racing in Le Mans or racing in Formula One, but for the biggest car buying market in the world, those are foreign events. We want to entice manufacturers to showcase their cars in the most American racing event there is, which is, of course, the 500. And I'd like to think that we've gone overboard in trying to be inclusive. Any manufacturer who really wants to step up to IndyCar, I think there's enough elbow room with the rules to entice them. And I absolutely know that they'll be welcomed with open arms, because we want to see manufacturers competing at the 500 just like 10, 15 years ago.
I'm very aware that Randy has a plane to catch, and I just want to put a final point to you, Randy, before we lose you. What I'm hearing here is a lot of great intentions. The decision's been made with regard to the Dallara tub. That's fine. What I'm not hearing too much of, and this may be deliberate, and maybe the consultative procedure is not finished, but I'm not hearing specifics here, Randy. And what we haven't got yet, and I'd like to know when we are going to get them, when are we going to get a set of technical regulations, when are we going to get a set of specifics where engine manufacturers, teams, anybody who's involved can actually sit down and have an offering that they can decide whether they want to get involved with, because after all, the spec of the car needs to be ready for January or February next year, so that if anybody is going to design the aero kits, they can get on with that. That's not the work of a moment, and to bring the potential other engine manufacturers in. Otherwise, it appears that what we're getting is more of the same, and Dallara Honda for another 4 years. Not that I'm saying there's necessarily anything wrong with that, but I'm just not hearing enough specifics here.
That's an outstanding question, and I think the most important thing for you to understand is that the Iconic Advisory Committee has had 80 days to put this together. We knew we needed to have something done by July 1 or near July 1. You know we need to have a technical person come on with us right now that is going to help write these rules. But I also think it's very important that we reach out to these manufacturers, and we want them as participants, yes, but we also want them as partners. We need to make sure that we are listening to what the auto manufacturers really think are important in this process as we write these technical rules. We want to reach out and talk to Cosworth. We want to reach out and talk to Ilmor. We want to reach out to the engine and auto manufacturer world and make sure that these defining rules are going to be what's fair and be very competitive, and also make sure that the auto manufacturers are engaged in this process, so that it's a win-win for everyone.
Is there anybody other than Honda at the moment, Randy? Specific question, is there anybody other than Honda at the moment who are out there ready to put a car an engine into an Indy car, into a Dallara chassis for 2012?
There's a tremendous amount of interest right now. There has been one that has told us that they would be more than willing to get involved by 2013. They weren't confident they could be involved by 2012, just from the standpoint of building an engine. They were going out doing their research. So, but our process was, hey, let's, you know, one of our objectives on our Iconic Committee was, is it best to wait till 2013 and not do 2012?
Yeah.
We made a very clear and decision that was probably not in our best interest. What was in our best interest was not to look at 2012, but to look much farther beyond 2013, 2014, and 2015. So that's not, you know, we're going into this with realistic reality that there could be a very good chance that we will only have one or two manufacturers in 2012 just because of the time frame. Mm. But the premise of this is what we get in 2013, 2014, and 2015.
I've been told from an industry insider that BMW said categorically that there's an engine that you can have that's based on their M3 engine that also runs in sports car racing, but that would be a stock block type engine and not a specific racing engine. If that is true, and maybe you can tell us if it is or isn't, does that not make you think again about the possibility of allowing in stock block or stock derived engines?
That's Tony. I will refer that to Tony and,
sure,
and Jill.
I can tell you this. I mean, this is, you know, in addition to what I told you just a second ago, you know, frankly, the regulations, I think as we envisage them today, will make no such distinction. What I mean by that is that the regulations are primarily talk about the maximum number of cylinders, the maximum displacement, the maximum amount of boost, the maximum amount of RPM, and also the and some weight requirements. You know, those are the shall we say the main parameters that we discussed during our meetings, you know.
And what is the general consent? sorry, Jim.
You know?
What's the general consensus on that? It'll be what, a V8, 3.4, or a 2.65? Where?
No. It's if you have studied the release, you know, it's a maximum of 6 cylinders, the maximum of 2.4 liters displacement. And then, to Randy's point, you know, there's been currently a lot of studies trying to figure out what the maximum RPM, the maximum boost, and maximum amount of fuel allowed to produce the kind of performance that we think an IndyCar needs to have.
To reinforcing what Randy said, if any manufacturer has an engine that they think is suitable and that they'd like to get behind running in the Indy Series, we're absolutely willing and excited to talk to them. Rumours like you mentioned with BMW were all very well, but our door is firmly open. And if a manufacturer wants to come in, let's talk.
Gilles, you were obviously sort of representing the teams on the Iconic committee. How much influence and how much were you able to interact, given that obviously a lot of the work that the committee was doing was covered under a non-disclosure agreement?
Well, I think the process that I went through was prior to the, shall we say, all of the discussions starting. I held several meetings with team owners and several principals of all the teams, with other Iconic members as well, and just kind of to have a bit of a free-form discussion about what they felt was important, what they felt wasn't important. You know, some meetings were longer than others, but I also produced a, shall we say, an extensive questionnaire, you know, with wide-ranging questions regarding engine, cars, the series, and what's important, what's not important, and so on and so forth. And both the conversations and the answers that I received in the questionnaires I used as, shall we say, a guiding light throughout the process. As you would expect, there was a lot of different opinions on wide-ranging subjects, but there were two very, I think, common themes that came very strongly through. One was the importance of bringing in, once again, automotive manufacturers, or making sure that we had an inclusive platform, as Tony rightly put. And the second thing was to keep development costs under control, so that the cost of running in the series wouldn't escalate it to a point that you know, it will be no longer sustainable. So those there were two very strong points that were coming through very strongly across the board.
Tony, I'm aware that we've kept you guys slightly longer than we were going to, so I'm going to wrap this up now. Tony, I've got a final question for you. As I said in the introduction, you have had a foot in many motorsport camps over the years. How much or how little would Formula One's return to the United States, with the Austin Grand Prix being mooted at the moment by Formula One and by Bernie Eccleston, how much do you think that will affect the growth of IndyCar, either positively or negatively?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, in that they are quite different series, but I did see some survey information, and there's a surprisingly large overlap between Formula One fans and IndyCar fans. And they're a little bit of a distinct bunch from the NASCAR fraternity. So I think it's a case of all publicity, all events are going to be good. If Formula One really created some noise in Austin, brought in a lot of fans, I think that would turn fans towards single-seater motor racing. And of course, they have a product in front of them locally with the IndyCar races. So yeah. I feel that success with Formula One in the States would actually enhance the fan base of IndyCar.
I agree with you, Tony, on that. I think, you know, we're a firm believer that all boats rise on a high tide, and I think that the racing industry needs to reach out and grow the industry. And one of the areas that the entire industry needs to reach out to is youth. And that should be a strong goal of all of ours in order to keep this motorsports world growing vibrantly.
we could keep you for hours. We won't. I've obviously, you'll appreciate, I've sort of grouped a few of those questions together from our ever loyal listeners here on Midweek Motorsport. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, Gilles de Ferran, Tony Pennell, and particularly on his way to the airport, Randy Bernard. Sir, it's an absolute pleasure to speak to you again. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
So that was what happened earlier on today. That was recorded, as you probably realised. Now, before anybody says anything, Tim Gray is our executive producer. Tim, you edited that, but only barely, didn't you?
I took out some of the satellite delay.
And Gilles de Ferran seemed to be on top of a mountain. You took some of that out.
I took out lots of wind noise. Gilles de Ferran did, as you heard a little bit of, have a lot of background noise, so I removed some of that. But
right.
Otherwise, that's unedited.
That's all of the questions and all of the answers. We didn't change that any way around. Sam Collins and Marshall Pruitt. Sam Collins from Race Car Engineering still owes me a subscription, and Marshall Pruitt from SpeedTV.com listened to that live this afternoon and have listened to it again, and we have given them an opportunity to listen to it a third time this afternoon at their own convenience. Nick Damon's been listening, and so has Declan Brennan. Before I bring in Marshall Pruitt, first of all, let's quickly go to the listeners collective, and I'm going to pick out one comment that pretty much sums up everything, Marshall, that the collective said, and indeed, frankly, we said after that is, Turbo Womble says, all I hear is lots of interest, lots of potential manufacturers. There's a good chance of this. We want to encourage that. We're talking to various people. We hope nothing concrete or definite apart from Dallara Chassis. The whole thing seems to be hanging on hopes, dreams, and fairy dust so far, if you ask me. That's what Turbo Womble says. Now, before we talk about the specifics of things that came out there that we weren't expecting, and there were some things, let's just talk about the general atmosphere and the tenet of the discussion that we had there. I asked for specifics. Frankly, we didn't get any.
No, Hindy, and what I wrote last week after the iconic announcement was, you know, would, could, maybe, might, and I got a lot of heat for it, to be honest, and I had a number of people write me to say that I was being too negative and being inaccurate, and if you read the documents, the transcriptions that the series sent out, you'll see where they've explained all these things, and there is actual specificity on things. So, not that I was looking for affirmation or confirmation, but the same general, this is where we're going, we know that Dallara is going to build a car, but we can't tell you a whole lot more than that. I think everybody got to hear that again live and in person today.
Out of it, and I'm going to bring the other people in, and we haven't got a huge amount of time. We're going to inevitably have to run over tonight a little bit, even though I've got to be at the airport in the morning. But what out of everything there either surprised you or disappointed you the most? Certainly we had that admission from Randy right at the beginning of Randy Bernard, right at the beginning of the interview, that the decision to use Dallara was made sometime before the 1st of July and was purely ratified by the iconic committee. Now, I'll be honest and say that rather took me by surprise, and I actually forgot to ask why they picked Dallara in the first place. I'm not sure that is really relevant, and I'm not beating myself too up for not asking that question, but that was a big admission, was it not?
It was, Hindy. I shook my head. I think everybody shook my head. Everybody shook their collective heads, and thank goodness I have to pay for that. That's usually expensive around where I live. Two things came to mind quickly, Hindy. Much like when you see any kind of court situation where you have someone on trial and you have their lawyer, and before the accused person says anything, they lean over to their lawyer, get the exact phrase to use, and then mm-hmm. speak it. Mm-hmm. The thing that came to mind was that Randy, while still very new in his role, I really think needs so IndyCar has an employee, a relatively new employee, but a very experienced guy named Steve Shunk, who I think would be perfect to kind of be Randy's traveling manager, PR person, not because Randy's inept, but simply because Randy a lot of times maybe doesn't know the sensitivities. I mentioned that for one quick thing, and then I'll leave this alone. To everybody who's listening, who loves IndyCar racing, who knows how heavy things are filled with speculation and conspiracy theories, and just for years. And recently, obviously, this is fixed. Dallara always had the contract, blah, blah, blah. When Randy comes out and says this decision was made July 1st, although it comes from his mouth with total innocence, to those that have an ear for the conspiracy theories, et cetera, and then watched the presentation last week where the panel, you know, quote, voted on the chassis and whatnot, it does nothing but feed into the belief that people are being lied to, that there are conspiracies, that this was not above board. I'm not going to weigh on whether it was or wasn't, because I've already done that plenty. But bottom line, protecting the message and or electing not to answer certain things, much like a Steve Shunk or a lawyer would tell someone to do. When Randy said that, it came out as a completely innocent statement. But man, if you wish you had a 5-second rewind to take that sucker back, that's exactly what you do.
Don't go away. I want to ask you something else in a minute. We've got Sam Collins from Race Car Engineering here. And Sam, I want to ask a few specific points on the technicalities, or the technical issues, rather, that we heard about. Tony Pannell is a man with a huge amount of experience in from Formula One downwards in motorsport. He was a protege of Max Mosley. He was at one time mooted to be potentially a replacement or a successor to Max Mosley at the FIA. He has a big reputation that has been gained over a very long time. He didn't seem very comfortable answering specifics on questions. He seems to think that $2 million is a tiny amount of money for to develop an aero kit that you can only sell for $70,000, which would mean that all 28 cars, in fact, if the $200,000 licensing fee is applied, you need to sell 31 of them to actually make your initial investment back. I'm unconvinced by his performance, to be honest.
I'm absolutely the same. Whilst the answers are very typical, Tony, I know him, I've seen him many times, you know, we know each other, he's related to the magazine. The actual, as you just mentioned there, the mathematics here are really clear. $200,000 for a license fee, $2 million to do the R&D to produce the body kits, $70,000 to sell the body kits, 28 got to sell to turn a profit without the license fee, with the license fee, 31 to sell. That means you have to supply most of the grid. Well, you're never going to do that. It's not going to happen. Frankly, supplying a body is not economically viable from where I can see it. And I'd love to see someone argue with me this, from Iconic on this, because I can't see how this makes financial sense. Unless, of course, you're a manufacturer like Lotus coming in and you have a marketing budget. Now, $2 million isn't a lot for a marketing budget for a company like Lotus in America. But, you know, really, when you look at the body, there's not very much you can change at all.
No.
And you're never going to get advantage over Dallara, so I think it's massively disappointing. And then the fact we don't have an engine deal, it sounds like we're heading towards a spec Honda engine again, which is a joke.
So are we going to get 28 Dallara Hondas all with the same kit on again?
I'd say that's almost certain. We might, maybe not 28, maybe 26. You might get two Penske-bodied cars, two Ganassi-bodied cars, two Lotuses, and maybe two of something else we don't expect, but, you know, domes or something. But I think that's really it, particularly if there's only a spec engine.
I can understand, you know, I can understand why Lotus might want to do it. They need to get some US exposure. I know that Roger Penske won't do it unless somebody pays him for it. He isn't going to put his own money into it. And Chip Ganassi won't do it unless he's got the money. I just don't understand. I need someone to explain to me why changing the bodywork on a car gives them the diversity and potentially as much diversity as if you opened up the engine regs would do, frankly.
It fundamentally doesn't. I mean, it's a really disappointing answer we've had from them tonight, and I think they really had the opportunity to... You had Lola there, quite capable of manufacturing whatever chassis with whatever safety requirements, as are Swift. Now, you had those three manufacturers in particular who have proven track records, proven capabilities, proven abilities. Why could they not all have made safety cells? You know, they make their own chassis, their own frontal crash structure, their own rear crash structure. You can stick in whatever engine meets the regulations, And then you can also do your own body. So Dallara could do a body pack for the Lotus, or the Lola. Lotus could do a body pack for the Swift, or any of the above. They missed a trick on this one, and I really think it was... It's a bit fishy, frankly.
In what respect?
Well, it seems to have been, from early comments and quotes and stuff I've read looking back through time, that, you know, it was a dead cert as a Dallara the whole time. So it seems that a lot of, you know, the other sort of guys who are pitching in, the Lolas, the Bats, the Delta Wings, were almost wasting their time.
I've got a quote here that goes back, and I'll bring Marshall back in on this as well. I've got a quote here that goes back to February 2009 that says, thanks to IndyCar's manufacturer roundtable meetings, the next generation of IndyCar will push the technical boundaries both on and off the track. Working tightly together with multiple engine manufacturers and the league has been and is invaluable to Dallara to design the exciting new chassis for IndyCar. Now, this was back on February the 9th, 2009, by Andrea Tozzo, head of research and development for Dallara. I kind of hear what Sam's saying, and I want to argue against it, Marshall, but it sounds as if this was an open and shut book beforehand. Now, that said, that might not have been a bad thing that they decided that more of the same was good. But if you look at what they were trying to achieve and the boxes they wanted to tick, they wanted some investment in Indiana, quite clearly. There's $5 million up for grabs there if somebody builds a facility there. I am told by very reputable sources from inside the industry that all of the major submissions included some kind of facility in Indiana. Everybody ticked that box. I'm told that cost cutting was a part of it. Everybody's ticked that box because everybody expected to be a sole supplier, which is what's happened. Out of a couple of other things, the one I want to pick out is fans. Now, two out of three of the major fan polls before this announcement had Lola as the favoured. As the favoured partner, the other one had Swift, and in all of the fan polls I've seen, Dallara came bottom or nearly bottom. So quite clearly, the core group of fans are not happy with this decision, and have made that very vociferously obvious since then. When Sam says it sounds a bit fishy, how fishy is it? I mean, are we talking a bit fishy, or are we talking one year big?
I think
there's a possibility of a little bit of revisionist history here. The fact is, Dallara has been the go-to IndyCar company for many years. There was some very, very underhanded stuff that happened well before Randy's arrival in regards to how the league treated the Panos company. Panos had come up with, it's funny, someone who was involved in submitting one of the 2012 proposals was indeed heavily involved in the Panos IndyCar proposal, when they came up with a new aero kit that would have basically made the Dallaras redundant. It was that big of a move, of a shift, and that was stricken down by Brian Barnhart under the auspices of it would cause all the teams to have to basically ditch their Dallaras. So that was really the where the line was drawn in the sand in terms of the league, you know, siding and partnering with Dallara. So with all that said, there was the things mentioned, was it 3 years ago or so, that a new chassis was needed, Dallara was looked to. There was no Delta Wing at that time, or BAT Swift, really, other than their Atlantic car, wasn't really thought of in that light. So I don't know if I'm defending Dallara per se or the league, but you have to keep in mind that if you try and line up some of when Andrea Tosa's statement came out at that time in the IndyCar series mind, with Tony George, if I think you said it was March or April last year, that was still Tony George in power, yada yada yada, Dallara was their main partner, so them talking about, you know, a future minded thing would not have been a surprise. Now granted, the fact that with Ben Bowlby kind of spurring the series to look at doing something different and, quote, radical, although that's not what we have. They shook things up. We now have this whole list of players that were candidates. But again, if you look back to 2009, it sure does look like this has been planned all along. But the fact is these new players really only came on earlier in the year. So I don't know. It doesn't surprise me. It saddened me that Dallara was chosen as the sole company, and not because I dislike them, but I do remember when things were good, when more than one company was tasked with providing a solution.
Nick Damon, our Formula One correspondent, has been there. Tony Pennell talked a lot, Nick, and you know Tony going way back the years from your 8 years in the Formula One pit lane and paddock. He talked a lot about people like Ferrari, McLaren, getting their hands dirty and getting involved in this. What is there for Ferrari or McLaren in making a body kit for someone else's chassis for a formula where their engine partners aren't involved?
The only reason for doing that would be if someone paid them to do it. There is no other reason for it. The thing that I don't understand, and I think it's interesting, there's nothing wrong with them giving the award to Dallara. Fine,
no, I'm
but
they're just
saying, Dallara, don't dress it up. It's you, and don't try and sop us all by saying, oh, we're going to make it a bit better with some kits, because it doesn't make a blind bit of difference. The problem they have is that, as I think Sam said, the only reason to make body kits, because it's financially unviable for Lowe to make a body kit or any other manufacturer, therefore you must do it for marketing reasons. With their TV ratings in the toilet, why would anybody want to use them as a marketing tool? They're between a rock and a hard place. They can't get their ratings up because they've designed a dull car no one's interested in, and therefore they can't get people to make the cars interesting.
How much... you've been around the Le Mans Series paddocks and Le Mans paddocks enough. You were at Le Mans in June. We've talked a lot with Marshall about global racing engines, and although I still maintain that one size doesn't fit all, there is a lot of talk from major manufacturers that IndyCar would love to get involved, not just American manufacturers, but global manufacturers, about standardising racing engines. They all seem to be based on some kind of stock offering. Have they missed a trick by not giving an advantage to a stock block offering, whether it's stressed or unstressed? And I know people say you can't have a stressed stock block, but Honda think you can, and there's clearly ways around it. There's nothing in what we've seen or heard about alternative technologies, nothing about alternative fuels, nothing about hybrids. You know, you've been close to Peugeot and to Audi and a number of other people. You've seen the kind of things that Zytec are doing. Have they missed a trick here with, you know, the sort of, well, I can only say vagaries of what we've heard about engines?
The fact is, we will be seeing, and I don't share Sam's optimism, just based on the financials, that in however many cars there are, 22, 24 or 26, as it stands today, we are going to see that many Dallara Hondas, because there is these days IndyCar is a series which is short of money, therefore it can't be innovative for innovative sake, therefore they can't risk being out on the limb, therefore they have to buy what's there. There won't be another engine because they've closed themselves off to it, and you know what, I don't think they mind that much. It's a safe decision to make. Nothing wrong with choosing Dallara, good manufacturer, safe cars, but they've dressed it up in a way, they've made everyone excited by having a bidding war, and they've over emphasized what could happen, and they've dashed everyone's hopes by going back to their old staid results. But that's what's going to happen. There's no way out of just this becoming a stock series. Yes, it won't be legislated as a stock series, but that's what it'll be on sheer economics.
No money, no interest to spend money. Interesting, very interesting. Declan Brennan, our midweek motorsport here on the Oval correspondent, our American correspondent. We had a chat after that this afternoon, and I said to you guys, we could have recorded our responses to it there and then, and we decided not to, mainly because Marshall was so annoyed, to be honest, but also to give everybody else a chance to calm down a bit. Now that you've seen this, you've been all over this, and you set that meeting up, that phone call up for us today. You've been watching how it's been reported on blogs, on websites, etc. Just give me a headline from you of what you take from that 40 minutes that we heard from Randy Bernard, from Gilles Dufresne, and from Tony Pennell. Dex.
I'll give you Let me see. If I was to go back and I watched it two mornings ago, the finale of the 2000 Michigan 500, it was a battle between two cars that are exactly the same, one a Ford, one a Honda. It was sensational. It was unbelievably high speed. Paul Page screamed about the fact that it was a battle between a Honda and a Ford. Mm. Behind them were two Reynards battling. It was Randy Bernard. It was Dario Franchitti and it was Max Pappas. Two Lotus in front, two Reynards behind. You couldn't tell the difference between them. And fundamentally, they looked the same, both with Hanford devices and tiny little front wings on running no aero. The cars looked the same. The difference was the engines. And that's what the commentators were shouting about. And they decided to go down the route of, and Nick's already talked about it, of a cosmetic route, which everybody will have to come up with the same answer anyway, because of all of the limitations they put on the initial chassis, the rolling chassis. I refuse to call it a safety cell because it's a rolling chassis. And therefore, what they've done is, yeah, come in and spend all your money to develop $2 million to $3 million, whatever it happens to be, to develop these body kits. And by the way, if you're Ford and you want to do it, you've got to put an engine in, because there's no way you're going to put a Ford in with a Honda boat, or even a Cosworth, so you want to have a Ford. So therefore, you have to spend the money on engines anyway, and that's the point of difference. So why not? I would have taken a spec chassis with a cradle that allowed multiple engines and cheap engines, like we know that there are cheap engines available. Go back to what we talked about a few minutes ago, but the list of engines for LMP2 that are now being talked of by including by Lola. And you suddenly realise if they'd done that, and we could have a host of cheap engines from manufacturers suddenly, and Marshall talked about it a couple of weeks ago, the key would be you'd have manufacturers spending their marketing dollars, because they don't have to spend it on producing a million, 2 million, 3 million, $10 million. I've heard quotes of $10 million to get a Cosworth engine ready in development to get it to the table. $10 million.
Go on, Dex.
So if you just opened the regs up with a non-stress member, production engines, you could have had loads of different points of difference and loads of people marketing shouting about their involvement. And right now, you're not going to have that.
Right.
We could easily end up with 26 Dallara Hondas next year, 33 Dallara Hondas at Indy.
Right, I'll come back to everybody for a final comment in a moment. It's already after 10 o'clock. We're into overdrive, extra time, call it what you will. Here's a few comments, some positive, some negative, from the Midweek Motorsport Listeners Collective on Facebook. And keep those comments going. We're at Lime Rock Park this weekend for full live coverage of the American Le Mans series, and we'll be watching what happens in the comments that come in, also on XM and Sirius as well. Check local listings for details. This from Steve Allen. Good questions. I'm sure that Randy and the guys will have more respect for them than the people who don't ask or just ask the obvious questions, but I'm not sure that Randy and the team were prepared to answer as honestly as Midweek Motorsport wanted that to. Okay, there may be some things they can't talk about at the moment, but to be fair, they did seem to understand what the fans want. This is all in my humble and non-IndyCar fans' viewpoints, says Steve Allen. This from Al Green, the Reverend. Listening to that, my initial reaction is they've got a tub and now they have to build a series around it. At the moment, they're clutching at straws and it's blowing a gale. Interesting. We've got... I want to... there was a comment here that I've... here we go. Emma Crawley. Hello, Emma. Hope you're feeling better. Emma says, why do I get the feeling these people thought everyone here would be impressed? I hope they read this thread. Anthony Thomas, who we've had our differences with in the past, Anthony, good comments tonight, mate. And, you know, he says, I want 20 minutes of my life back. They haven't said anything that have really... that's really moved him. Paul Davis, stressed stock blocks can be stressed a bit and a lot. I don't see what the problem is. Quite a few people talking about the question about, you know, what the differences were between the submissions. As I said in the interview, we ran out of time, but I wanted to ask if they would possibly make the non confidential part, i.e. the business part, the numbers part of the submissions public, and maybe that's something we'll still do with Randy to see what the differences were. But I'm led to believe that most of the submissions, they were within $5,000 of each other per chassis, and all of the major players wanted to put a facility in Indiana. Right, that's it from the Facebook at the moment, but I want you to keep the questions or the the comments coming in to Midweek Motorsport Listeners Collective. Let's just wrap up this week whilst we're in overtime and go back to each one of our contributors, and we'll start with Marshall Pruitt. Marshall, you've been very close to this. You were at the initial reaction. The question I have to say at the initial press conference, rather, the question I have to ask to you: do you feel short-changed having been at that initial release of the announcement, in that we heard quite categorically there that the decision was already made, and what you witnessed was effectively a piece of theatre?
Yeah, Heidi. I mean, I think I've made that well known last Wednesday. Mm. If I had one thing to wrap up, and I'll touch on what Deck said, and it's, you know, something more than a few people have said. When you think of fans of auto racing, when I think of them in general, people tend to stray toward marques. If it's Australian V8s, it's Ford versus Holden. Pick whatever it is that you follow, NASCAR, F1, whichever. People tend to follow marques more than anything. So if I'm looking at how to get people interested, I've heard in terms of aero kit names, McDonnell Douglas and Lockheed, GE, you name it, those are not entities that the average fan will get behind, will support, because they're meaningless. The person that makes my refrigerator, General Electric, could make an aero kit for an Indy car. I could care less. But I do have two vehicles, one of them made by Mitsubishi and one by Ford. Well, you know what? Personally, if I'm looking at areas to open and expand technology, to give someone free rein to do something, the auto manufacturers tend to be the companies that fans have allegiances towards, not a plane manufacturer, an electronics manufacturer. And people might even love Swift or love Lola or pick whomever else, but it's a minority. If you're looking at how to get a lot of new people, right, that's what this is all about, right? Not making the teams have fun to spend millions of dollars in 2012, but how to reinvigorate IndyCar racing. That comes from fans, and fans tend to have allegiances toward marques. So going in a direction where aero has been opened up, where you just don't have, let's be honest, how many people walk or say, God, I love aero. You know, this company over here, they're my favorite. That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So to me, to Dex's point, to many people's point, I like the idea of having aero creativity, but the fact is I would rather things been slanted and most of the presentation been pushed towards, look at what we're doing, engine marks, engine manufacturers. That's how we're going to get people to come in and play and spend their ad dollars. It just seems totally shifted in a direction where there's no fans waiting.
Marshall Pruitt, speedtv.com, thanks for being with us. I expect we will see plenty about this on speedtv.com in the future. Sam Collins, before I let you go, I want to play you a clip that comes from Duncan Dayton, the head man at Highcroft Racing over in the American Le Mans series. And this is what he said to me at the start of the year at the Wheels Down Winter Test about attracting GE, General Electric, to be a sponsor in the American Le Mans series. Have a listen to this, and I'm going to ask you a question off the back of it, because I think it's entirely relevant to what we've been talking about.
However, we're absolutely ecstatic with the partnership with GE. It's on two fronts. First and foremost, the sponsorship front, for them to entertain corporate guests and help them get additional business, which we've been able to already do in a short period of time. So that's on one front. The second front is with a technical relationship with a global research lab. And for those of the listeners who may not be aware what GE's technical capabilities are in their labs, it's one of the top two or three labs in the world. It's a whole campus of buildings, and they have everything from metallurgy, lubricants, aerodynamics, power system sensors.
Wow.
It's fantastic.
And an engineer's dream.
It's something like 3,600 engineers on staff. So, and
you know you can't bring all of them into the pit lane, don't you?
No, there's not quite enough room. We don't have enough headsets, but if we could, we would. But it's been great, and we're sort of a skunk works for them to test some of their new technologies. It's as close to a military environment as they can come up with, but obviously a lot safer and a lot less expensive. So they're excited about the opportunity, and we're absolutely excited about it as well.
So that was Duncan Dayton talking to me about
innovation, about different answers to questions, about people being able to prove technology. A skunk works for GE, he described the P2 program in the American Le Mans series. I'm not seeing or hearing that within IndyCar, but then again, it's a spec series. Should I be surprised? Should IndyCar be taking the opportunity to take up that mantle of technology, or is it just not right for them, Sam?
Well, that's a really short answer. Yes, they should be taking up that opportunity. Of course they should. IndyCar used to be, when it was in one of its various other names, was a multi-chassis, multi-engine, multi-gearbox international championship, going to South America, North America, a few flyaways like Surface Paradise, things like that. And the Indy 500.
Japan, UK, yeah.
Japan, the odd one to UK. And that's what it was. That's what was great about it. That's what everybody loved. And the multi-chassis thing. Just go on the IndyCar website and have a look at the fans who attended the meeting along with Marshall, the announcement, the bit of fear, as you call it, and see what they say. They all come out and say, I'm disappointed. We could have done with one more chassis at least. Mm. And that's what they should have done. There's no excuse not to have done it, in my opinion.
Can I play devil's advocate before I let Tim in on this? Is there room in that marketplace, in a series that, let's be honest, has less than 500,000 people watching on Versus TV of each round, probably 50,000 people watching live in the UK on Sky TV? Is there room for the kind of investment that's needed to have more than one chassis, or all of these assumptions that we're making, putting Indy further up the ladder and trying to make it more successful than it really is now?
Yes, it would be a lot more successful if it had more than one chassis. If it doesn't have more than one chassis, it's just glorified GPT. It's as simple as that. Who watches GPT? Nobody. Who watches this? Nobody. And until they bring other chassis in, nobody will watch it.
Sam Collins from Race Car Engineering. Tim has a question from you before you go.
I can't remember how long ago it was, but I do remember on a previous show, maybe at the start of this year, might have been last year, it might even have been 2 or 3 years ago, we were talking with Sam about future IndyCar chassis, and there was a view of having the same chassis for both IndyCar and Indy Lights and just bolting on different aero panels.
Mm.
Which was a great idea.
Is that still an active idea, do we think?
Well, they did say that currently it's not something they're looking at, but they haven't ruled it out. I think they probably will do it long term. Lola put in that fantastic proposal that it was very simple to switch from one to the other. So it does make perfect sense. At the end of the day, you need to go round an oval and be safe, and that's really the most important with these chassis. You need to be safe at that high speed. And one thing I think I should clarify is I'm not knocking Dallara here. The Dallara will be a really good racing car.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get that wrong.
I don't think anybody's saying other than that, yeah. Sam, to be honest.
We're just a bit disappointed there's no one to take on Dallara, and I think Dallara's engineers would probably be a bit disappointed by that as well.
What I would say is what I think will happen as far as Indy Lights is concerned is the current chassis will become the Indy Lights chassis. That works on two levels. If they've got any sense, it will be. Works on two levels. One, the current teams could then potentially run a satellite team for not a lot further in investment. The smaller teams can have a ready market for the current chassis and spares package that they have to be able to fund them buying the new chassis. There's no point in making the current chassis completely and utterly redundant. You might as well roll that into Indy Lights and give it some longevity.
No, on safety grounds, John, you can't actually do the composite chassis. It's very little reported fact, but composite chassis do actually age. So anything much more than 3 years, they can really get a bit ropey and unsafe. And I think there's some pictures kicking around the internet of like a Ferrari, 1998 Ferrari, with the driver's front leg sticking out after he brushed the tyre wall. You know, he was unhurt.
In a historic race. Yeah, I've seen that, yeah.
Exactly. And these chassis do start to delaminate after time. You can't keep a composite chassis going indefinitely. So really, for safety's sake, I think they just need to sort of bring in new cars. Whether they're new cars from the same old moulds, or just new cars, it doesn't really make a difference. But they can't just, like in NASCAR, where you sell the old tube frame to a Nationwide team, you can't really do that because they age too much. So it's not really safe to do that, I don't think.
Okay, Sam, thanks for being with us. Don't forget, you still do owe me that
subscription. Thank you very much.
You will indeed get it, John, but all the listeners will get a free one first.
Yeah, right, okay. I noticed you've been doing a bit of plugging on the Midweek Motorsport Listeners Collective tonight and Race Car Engineering. If you're of the mind to listen to this show, you will enjoy Race Car Engineering. So it's very well written, and it's the sort of thing that you read and go, ah, that's why that happened. Sam, thanks very much for being with us tonight, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again in the near future.
Thanks for
that, Sean. So we're left then with Tim Gray, with Nick Damon, and with Declan Brennan. Declan, as I said before, you've been following this story. There's a lot more to this than meets the eye. I'm afraid to say that as a conspiracy theorist, I always, my hackles pretty well, maybe because I lived with a detective inspector for 30 years of my life, my father, and I'm just, you know, naturally that way inclined. However, it is true that Dallara had one major asset in its locker throughout this whole process, in that it had an IndyCar insider working for them at the time.
Well, this is back to Marshall, so I'll finish with 2 points, and this will be the first one. This is back to Marshall's, and I completely agree with him that we have no reason to believe that this is underhand in any way. But you need to make sure that that's seen to be the case.
Correct.
And it really doesn't help when members of the Holman George family are working on internship at Dallara and tweeting about it during the process and celebrating with them and saying, "I'm celebrating with Dallara during the process."
And this would be who?
Lauren George, who is Tony George's daughter and runs the Indy Lights team, effectively owns the Indy Lights team. And that just, you know, again, we're not saying anything other than the fact that that sort of thing really shouldn't happen. Or you should be wise enough to make sure it doesn't get into the public domain. If I'm sure it's perfectly legit, but man alive, don't let it get out there, and don't let me be able to go and find it and work back through a tweet line and see when she got to Italy, where she was, you know, all of that. That's just ridiculous. And I will say one last thing. I really think, unfortunately, Robin Miller summed it up when he said, "People don't care what the side of the car looks like. 1% of people care about the technicalities under the car." I think Robin and IndyCar, if that's the case, if you're speaking for IndyCar, you must think we're all stupid, because that's not the case. I love what's going on below the hood, so to speak, and I'm also not that stupid to realise that the wind tunnel work is going to give us cars that look exactly the same. So it'll be all about what's under the engine cover.
Exactly.
And that's the thing that annoys me the most. You're not giving us enough respect, and you're not treating us with enough intelligence. And Randy, I'm a big fan. We're all big fans. I think he's got a massive job in his hands. But Randy, I think you've really, really let us down.
He's got a big salesman. He's a very good salesman, and he's going to have to use all his skill.
And
to
I hope he works. I hope he's right. No. I don't want it to fail.
I like him a lot. I like the access that we've been given. And let's be honest, if we were doing the same sort of expose Nick Damon on Formula One, not expose, but, you know, treatment on Formula One, we wouldn't have got the decision makers to talk to us for half an hour as they did right there this afternoon. Final word from you, Nick. And we've got to bring up the Formula One thing again. Is it just a massive coincidence that the 2012 IndyCar regs we're talking about, and we're talking about a 2012 Austin Formula One, and that Tony Pinnell, a man who is Formula One, is part of the decision? I mean, you know, am I being too cynical to suggest that Tony Pinnell is there either looking after the Formula One interests, or at least, you know, being there making sure that IndyCar is where IndyCar should be as far as FIA and Bernie Eccleston's concerned?
No, that is too Machiavellian. But I think what he's more desperate to do is to try and hang on F1's coattails, or on the single-seater coattails. The previous thing that Declan raised about them saying people aren't interested what's under the car, what they have to realise at the moment, all IndyCar has is the anorak audience. They don't have Joe Soap going, "Oh, I've got to see an IndyCar race," because he's either watching baseball or NASCAR. So they have to, at the moment, they have to appeal to people who are interested in what goes on, how many, yeah, the boost levels, the fuel tank size, and everything. And then they have to try and get those people to evangelize to their normal, inverted commas, friends to come and watch the programs as well. But the hooks there, they haven't got. You never have hooks with the spec series. People love F1. It's Ferrari against McLaren. It's Hamilton against Alonso. It's Red Bull. You've got those distinct teams and distinct personalities. You don't have distinct teams or distinct personalities in IndyCar when the cars are all the same. and the engines are all the same. What hooks in, you know, Fred Bloggs and Joe Bloggs don't know who Ganassi and Penske are. They do know who Ferrari are.
Yeah, I'll give you that. Nick, thanks for being with us. Declan, you are our American correspondent. There's one other thing I want to talk about here before we go on. It's got nothing to do with what we've heard today and everything to do with how many people watch. I've mentioned it a couple of times, but one of the things, although we asked people for comments on the iconic committee, we got comments and other things on the website, and the most profligate of them in terms of a single subject was the broadcasting, whether it was on Versus or the internet. How easy or difficult is it going to be for Indy to get an international audience or even a decent American national audience with the broadcast coverage that they're getting now? And it's difficult for me to talk about this because clearly this is what we do. And to be honest, we did a little spoof test broadcast at Long Beach. Jeremy Shaw and I decided, just because we were there at the end of an American Le Mans series session, that we would stay there. And I promise you, there was literally no preamble to it. We went into it and put it together without any research or background, which we probably should have done. Thank goodness Jeremy Shaw's a god when it comes to that. But how difficult is it for IndyCar to grow with the sort of things that I'm seeing people say about its TV and internet and radio coverage?
It's going to be very difficult to grow in Versus. There's only going to be so far it can grow for so many reasons we've discussed before. Where it is on the American version of the EPG, we're running over, so my wife's trying to get a hold of me. One of Randy's main points will have to be the Comcast deal with NBC. And I think that, because we saw ABC, for example, got a one for the Toronto race, which is exactly the same as last year, which in the grand scheme of things is good. Flatlining in this economy, no matter what you're doing, is good, and maintaining viewers, so that's encouraging. He needs more network races. That's going to be the key. He's got to get more network races. He also has to develop an international product as well, and to that point, and I'm going to big you up, they need to go back to, and I actually talked to him about this morning, they need to go back to an international feed that treats the product properly, because the international audience is an intelligent one. It's the Formula One audience. Nick just talked about them. They know what they're looking for. They understand open wheel. He needs to do something with that. But fundamentally, it's about getting on network television. It's getting more casual eyeballs, and that's going to be network TV.
So casual eyeballs, I like that.
Yeah. So, and I think we should. Do you think we should do for a couple of days or one day only? Stick the IndyCar Radio Le Mans coverage up online.
Well, it wasn't really coverage.
Chatting with shouting.
It was just two blokes
looking at one corner,
talking about what they could see in front of them. If Tim can organise that, we'll do
Declan,
it.
Declan, are you suggesting that they were both at the same corner?
No,
IndyCar radio coverage.
That'd be terrible. One of them should have been on the south end of the circuit.
Well, the situation was, we were in a hospitality cabana at the Long Beach Grand Prix. That's absolutely true. And we started talking about the future of IndyCar. And actually, the first 15 minutes is Jeremy Shaw talking about what we've heard, the run-up to what we've heard tonight. And it's very spooky listening to that, considering that it was Jeremy was making his comments 3 months ago when this
procedure that's worth keeping on, because Tim and I were talking about whether we should edit that out, and I think it's actually interesting. It's that chat's worth
Tim,
leaving
can we stick
on
it up? We'll stick
retrospect.
It up till after the weekend.
If you have a look on the Midweek Motorsport page of RadioLeMans.com, you'll see it at the top of the podcast list.
Right, there you go. That's for those of you that are listening now. I've got to tell you that it's been a record week on the Midweek Motorsport Listeners Collective on Facebook. For those of you who haven't been before, thank you for coming. Thank you for your... I've seen a lot of new names. Obviously, we haven't been able to name check everybody. This afternoon, I tried to group as many of the types of questions to Randy and the team as I could. I gave some people name checks, I couldn't give others, but you'll have recognised the sort of questions that you've asked that we put to the CEO of IndyCar and two of the iconic committees. For those of you that are new, we do this every week at 8 o'clock UK time on a Wednesday night, or you can catch up on the website. We're on RadioLeMans.com and on iTunes, and Tim will turn around the podcasts as quick as we can. This is not just what we do. We'll be at Lime Rock Park at the weekend, bringing you full, live and exclusive free coverage of the next round of the American Le Mans Series. This year we've also covered Le Mans 24, the Nürburgring 24, and we've got plenty more to come throughout the season, including the remainder of the Le Mans Series, which is right throughout the season and ends at Petit Le Mans. Once again, it's Lime Rock live this weekend on Friday and Saturday. My thanks to Declan Brennan and Nick Damon, our two regular contributors. Tim Gray, the voice of reason, or one of them at least, is our executive producer in London. Our responsible adult is my beautiful wife, Eve Hewitt, who sat very close to me when we were doing all of those pre-records this afternoon to make sure that we stayed the right side of every line. I'd also like to thank Sam Collins from Race Car Engineering and Marshall Pruitt from SpeedTV.com, as well, of course, as Randy Bernard, the CEO of IndyCar, the Indy Racing League, excuse me, and Gilles Deferrin and Tony Pennell. They were true stars today. I understand we asked them some difficult questions, but they gave us the time to do that. And whatever else you think about what they said, didn't say, answered or didn't answer, they put themselves out there, and we respect them and thank them for that. My name's John Hindhoff. This was a special edition of Midweek Motorsport on RadioLeMond.com. Bye for now.
This programme is a Radio Show Limited production. For more, go to www.radiolemond.com. Radio Show Limited. We talk to the world.